And now we're going to commence with part four, The Modern World. I don't know about you, but it's been a while since I was thinking about part three. As a matter of fact, it's been a while since I've been thinking about any of this stuff. It's been taking me a while to record this. And my guess is, considering the amount of material there is to absorb, it has probably taken you a long time to listen to it. That's fine. So let's just remind ourselves a little bit of what we just listened to. In all of history, we've seen a progression from non-individual societal or community or communitarian or cultural or whatever you want to call it, a move away from that toward the individual and the celebration and the understanding and the protection of the individual. The invention, perhaps, of the individual. And I want to point out something that's really important for you to remember as we go forward, and probably when you think about what we've already said. I am not here looking up the precise meaning of post-narrative, pre-modern, modernista, whatever. This is not an exercise in finding the right academic name for things. You can do that all on your own at some other time. Go to college, spend $150,000, $200,000. You'll get all the right names. I don't care what the right names are. What I care about is that you understand the concepts. And as we come into the modern world, what we have in our hands now is a formed idea of the individual. And the question is, what do we do with it? For us, the modern world will begin with the machine age, as in post-industrial revolution, the nebulous point at which business has moved from the home to the factory. And the world is just beginning to see the machines and inventions that will dominate the 20th century. Now, I know you'd like to pin this down exactly at some point between November 14, 1811 and May 8, 1926, but history does not have such neat chapters, and I don't make such neat claims. It's like I don't label these things postmodernista, whatever, anti-structuralist, post-structuralist, blah, blah, blah. Again, $200,000, you can get that at college. We're going for concepts here. Anyhow, if you're worried that with this kind of vague understanding of when the modern happens, that the modern overlaps the pre-modern, whatever we were just talking about in the last episode, don't. There is no bright line of modernity that we can cross from the old to the new. Our narrative instinct doesn't like this kind of vagueness, but the dots aren't always that easy to connect. And remember, that's what narrative does, connects the dots, and that's what we're doing here. Now, at this point, and that point somewhere between November 14th, 1811, and May 8th, 1926, at this point in time, horrible expression, the big question is, with all that movement toward individuality that we saw in arts and politics, what is shaking in thought that is going to make a difference? We're not going to go into every detail of it, just as we didn't go into every detail of previous philosophies, but the big difference in the modern world and what came before is the developing new approach to reality. And here there really is a bright line comparison between the old and the new. And to understand this, we have to think ontologically. We have to think about the nature of existence. I love saying things like ontological. Ontology. Nature of existence. Let's go back a bit. The empiricists, like John Locke, thought that we could know reality through the experience of our senses, that we could understand the objective world by living in it, breathing it, seeing it, hearing it, smelling it, touching it. The rationalist thought that we could understand reality simply by using our minds to figure it out. These two groups are obviously fundamentally in disagreement about approach to ontology. But they did agree that there was an objective universe that could be understood. By the time we get to the modern age, the most prominent theorists believe that there is no way of knowing the objective world. They take empiricism or rationality or any brand of thought you like and point out that it all boils down to you vis-a-vis you. That is, the only thing you can know is what it is that you, as an individual, know. Reality, to you, is your own subjective reality. As Kierkegaard put it, we have subjective existence, modified by objective reality, but can only know the subjective. This, in a word, is relativism. The objective world doesn't matter anymore. Taken to its logical extreme, the objective world may not even exist. And some postmodern thinkers do indeed posit that there is no objective reality, but Kierkegaard gives us a better construct. Our subjective reality is affected by the objective, but all we can truly know is that subjective. That's the core of existentialism. From this, Sartre postulated that a man is defined by his actions, not his existence. By the time we start analyzing the postmoderns, the construct of relativism is firmly fixed. You can read all the modern philosophy you want to get a better feel for it. As far as we're concerned now, you need only understand the concept and understand that the concept pretty much underlies all of modern thought. All right. Let's focus in a little bit. Let's talk about the 20th century, the modern age of the 20th century. As far as the modern age is concerned, it's important to remember that it is different from previous ages in dramatic ways. And this difference is a very important aspect of modernism. Before the modern age, everyone lived in their grandparents' world, which was their grandparents' world. That is, if you were born in 1700, your life was virtually no different from your parents' life, or their parents' life, or their parents' life, going back as far as you want. Technological advances were slow and would have little effect on you. The biggest change in your century might be the development of a better plow. This means more rutabagas come rutabaga season, but not much else. Starting with the modern age, your world is completely different from your grandparents, or even your parents. Look at my grandmother. I mean, this is literal now. She was born in the early 1880s. The airplane had not been invented, nor had the radio, or the car, or Coca-Cola, which was invented in 1886. When she died in the early 70s, she could have theoretically watched a movie on the Concorde while drinking a Diet Coke. My grandmother's grandmother, however, lived through no such evolution of technologies or beverages. Airplanes, radios, and cars, and television, among other inventions, changed the world in the 20th century in major ways. From, say, 1850 or so, there seems to be change after change, and they seem to come faster and faster. And this is still true. If you were born before 1990, you were born in a world where there was no internet to log on to. If you were born before 1981, there was no personal computer. If, like me, you believe that the information transmission aspects of the internet are a major revolution, then you probably have managed to have it occur entirely during your lifetime. Considering that instant transmission of information requires a fast pipeline, and ubiquitous fast pipelines like cable modems are a product of the turn of the millennium, this particular revolution is still wearing virtual diapers. So what are some of the particulars of the modern age? Well, if information and knowledge are important, then the fact that news began to travel fast compared to the past, although slow compared to us today, may be key. This may be key. Look at the progression. Word of mouth. News travels by word of mouth. Gutenberg. International sailing ships. Telegraph. Telephone. Radio. Think about the difference in information processing with and without the internet. Radio is a comparable historical difference in its time. With radio, you can hear it as it happens. With television, you could see it as it happened. With the internet, of course, you can talk about it, see it, hear it, taste it. You're practically in it. By loosely the 20th century, the so-called modern age has become the age that most Western people actually live in. In other words, there's no holdout pocket still living the way they lived hundreds and hundreds of years ago that are in any way, shape, or form meaningful. And what are some of the important things that comprise that modern age? Mechanization. The world of manufacturing has become the world of assembly lines. No longer does a craftsman make a chair. A mindless human cog at 0.27C on the assembly line screws in his assigned chair bolt. We've come to the point where we actually believe in people as individuals, and the first thing we do is take away their individuality and give them a job that a robot could do, and eventually would do. Okay, what else do we have in the modern age? Mass murder in warfare. The American Civil War was only a local taste of the new meaning of war, where instead of a few professional troops maneuvering against one another, vast armies slugged it out for long periods at great human cost. World War I had a staggering effect on the European mind. 8.5 million people, 8.5 million people died for little or no change in the geopolitical map, except, of course, the blaming of Germany and the ensuing World War II. A war that probably shouldn't have happened stripped nations of an entire crop of young men. Imagine the effect today if we took every single person in college and killed them. It would be comparable to World War I. Okay, what else do we have? The end of colonialism. Or at least the end of the nations of the West as they had been previously conceived. The kings were dead, mostly. The adventures abroad were coming to an end. This is closely linked with the political aspects of World War I. We have the rise of communism. The concept of the state is radically different under Marx than previously. Capitalism is the de facto fundamental underpinning of economics in the West from time immemorial. It may not have been known as such, but that's pretty much what we were doing. Communism comes along and it's an attack on that fundament. And a successful one, very successful one, transforming entire nations. Could there indeed be a world where the state was designed to support the worker? We have the birth of popular culture. The modern age begins to approach universal literacy. Everyone reads newspapers, anyone can read books. Radio allows music to reach a mass audience. Movies are a new art form, primarily for a mass audience. Suddenly there are such things as bestsellers, popular music, especially jazz insofar as there's an intellectual pomp. This can be seen as tying into the mechanization mentioned before. All those cogs in the automated factory are at least making a living. And popular culture is how they spend their money. A Marxist might say it's how they waste their money. We have incredible scientific breakthroughs. Albert Einstein should probably get the credit for the most mind-boggling science since he claimed that matter equals energy. He's also responsible for quantum, which he vilified, which claims that essentially the universe is based on probabilities rather than certitudes, and which therefore leads to the ultimate relativistic universe. Reality is dependent on how you measure it. Or even more simply, reality depends on you. It's one thing when philosophers say the world is relativistic. I mean, philosophers are just sitting around yapping at each other. It's another thing altogether when scientists prove it. On the practical level, technology gives us automobiles, which allow people total personal mobility, and flight, which eliminates borders of time and space in much the same way as did the theory of relativity. And we have urbanization. The cities are growing as economies shift. People are moving away from their personal center, the farm they never ventured more than a few miles from for the last 20,000 years. And cities are, metaphorically, a lot crueler than small towns. Okay, so we have all those big things working. Let's just go over them one more time. Mechanization. Mass murder and warfare that people had actually lived through. The end of colonialism, the end of kings. The rise of communism, where we just turn the entire economic system inside out. The birth of popular culture, a mass market of people who want entertainment, information, who want culture. We have scientific breakthroughs of a boggling, mind-boggling nature that may prove the universe is exactly opposite what we thought it was. And we have the growth of big cities and everything that that entails. The upshot of all of this is that the world has gotten bigger and people feel smaller. People are no longer the center of the universe. They're cogs again, the way Plato painted them in class systems, except now they're cogs in an inhuman, perhaps even inhumane machine. In essence, we see a movement from humanism to dehumanization. And now the conceptualized modern age can be examined. In the age of humanism, we celebrated the individual. What do we do in the age of the modern? How should things be done in this new world we have created? For us, in our history of the narrative, the story of stories, if you will, how do the narrators, the artists of that time, the thinkers of that time, how do they react? They've seen and lived in the modern age, and they also know and understand the past. What does the thinking artist do that is a new modern way? What we will see is a redefinition of the creative process, or at the very least, a new examination of those processes, and this redefinition defines for us modernism. In these redefinitions, narratives are taken to their extremes, and then pass them. In the pre-modernist narrative, it was about the story, the content. In the modernist narrative, it is about the telling of the story. In a nutshell, it is no longer about the narrative, it is about the narration. Underline that, circle it, mark it with a big star. In a nutshell, it's no longer about the narrative. It's about the narration. Let me tell you what happened. Let's look at painting. Now remember everything we've said so far about painting. I mean, the history of painting, to a great extent, so far, has been the learning how to do it better so that the painting, for all practical purposes, became more realistic. It looked more like real life. So if you look at a painting of, the 17th century, 18th century Flemish painters, for instance, you look at their portraits, you look at their landscapes, you look at whatever it is they're doing, you look at it and you say, boy, that's really good. That really looks like that thing that they're trying to paint. As compared to, say, looking at, say, a painting in 1400, where it might be a little flat. You know, the faces really don't look perfect yet. They haven't discovered ways of making it look, well, you know, realistic. I mean, it looks like people, but it doesn't look really like people. So, what does that mean in the age of the modern, where it's no longer about the narrative, it's no longer about the content, it's about the narration? Okay, let's go back again. Let's look at painting in the pre-modern, and let's break it down. Painting consists of a variety of basic concepts. There is composition. Composition is the way a painting is arranged. There are actually rules of composition, a compendium of right and wrong about the organization of elements in a design. There's perspective. which imparts realism to a painting so that it looks more lifelike. You know, what's in front, what's in back, how does everything relate to each other? That's perspective. When it's wrong, things don't look right. When it's correct, things look the way they're supposed to look. And as I think we mentioned earlier, perspective was invented. It had to be learned by artists. Then there's color and brush technique, the basic skills that the artist must master to have the painting look right. I mean, all the painters, the great painters of history, learned from their predecessors how to work the brushes, how to make the brush strokes that looked like, well, skin, because it would be nice and clean and fine and shiny, or leaves might be a little fluffy, a little different kind of brush stroke for that. Paintings, of course, can be used for record keeping. For instance, capturing the portrait of famous or, well, not so famous persons or events. Go to a museum, look at the paintings of the 1700s, the 1800s, the 1500s. Many, many, many of those paintings have famous, probably rich people in them. Those are the people who could afford to have a portrait painted or who had deserved or earned to have a portrait painted. There's the other thing that painting would do, would be storytelling. We've talked about this endlessly. A painting could be a story of mythological gods and goddesses, religious figures, or any events real or imagined. Remember, art historically, up till now, has been about gods and goddesses, and it's been about heroes. Now, in the pre-modern age, it became more about individuals. It's still about people, and it's still about storytelling to a great extent, even if the story is merely the average everyday story of Joe Everyman. Now, the thinking artist looks at these concepts, concepts of perspective and composition and color and brushwork, and asks, what do they mean? They're the accepted principles, but are they correct? Are they necessary? And by the way, this raises the question, is the artist among the leading thinkers of the time? Since the great humanistic age, I would answer yes. If great thought is limited to great thinkers, it's sterile. Great thought must find its expression in great actions. Artists are great actors in the act of creation. One key issue facing painters at this point is the invention of photography. Okay, the modern age is very much, when it comes to painting, affected by the invention of photography. Whereas once if a moment was going to be recorded historically, it was drawn, maybe as it happened, more likely from memory or from conjecture, now it can be photographed with infinitely more realism. A photograph can provide a completely accurate portrait of a sitter in minutes. Photography almost immediately becomes the de facto medium of record keeping the minute it's invented, replacing painting in this area and replacing a need for painting in this area. And in many cases, photographs can also exist solely for the presentation of aesthetic beauty, just like a painting. So if you're sitting around seriously thinking about art, about making a statement, how do you do it in the modern age? Well, you throw out the old, stop thinking about the subject of the painting, and start thinking about the process of painting. You replace the importance of the narrative with the importance of the narration. Question: what if perspective didn't matter anymore? Cubism is an attempt to create three dimensions in a painting, which is all that perspective is about. Remember, a painting is a two-dimensional thing. It's on a canvas, it's a rectangle, it's a square, it's whatever it is, but it's two dimensions. It has length and breadth, but it doesn't have depth. What cubism does is attempt to create depth, not through perspective, but through a new kind of perspective, a sort of ad hoc 3D. In Duchamp's New Descending a Staircase, for instance, the subject of a painting is not only three-dimensional, it is now moving no longer caught in time. A painting, if you're going to paint an action, is going to be a moment in time. Nude descending a staircase is an object coming down those stairs, a lot of stairs. There's movement in a still painting. Duchamp kills two birds with one stone, the static quality of a painting and the two-dimensionality. As I say, he's trying to see it from all sides. Look at Picasso, where a subject's eyes are both on the same side of the face. I mean, you know that Picasso kind of look, eyes on the same side of the face. Picasso isn't saying that his subject is a flounder. He's questioning perspective and turning it on its ears, or, well, he's turning it on its eyes. What about paint itself? In the old, we used paints in different colors to capture reality. Of course, we tried to make those colors the colors that we actually saw as painters. Now, with the fauves, a fauve was a translation of the concept of wild beast. They were called the fauves, F-A-U-V-E-S, a whole school of painting. With the fauves, color explodes on the canvas. And the painting is about color itself as much as the subject. Trees, which would be green, are now red, and water, instead of being blue-green, is yellow or white or whatever. The whole color scheme is thrown out of whack. It's wild. Rather than mixing subtle realistic colors, as painters had before, wild colors are taken right from the tube, okay? You know, painters like to mix colors. You gotta get that just right, flesh color, just right, green, and then another darker green, and a tree is made up of 57 different greens. Fauves are just getting a tube of paint, right down on the easel, slap it onto the canvas, and you got your color, and it's bright as can be. So in the old, you learned to apply brush strokes onto the canvas. In the new, you just splash the paint on the canvas like Jackson Pollock. What is Jackson Pollock doing? Go look up Jackson Pollock's pictures if you're not familiar with them. Dribble paintings. What's this all about? Up until Jackson Pollock, at least artists decided to take their brushes and brush against the canvas. He's trying something altogether different. And the remarkable thing is, I mean, it took me a long time to look at a bunch of Pollocks and all of a sudden realize, my God, this is gorgeous work. This is fantastic. On the other hand, it's pretty easy to imitate, or at least it seems like it's easy to imitate. It's easy to say, oh, anybody could do that. I dare you to do it and have something that looks good. I dare you to imitate Pollocks. People have tried to do this, have tried to sell paintings that they claimed were Pollock paintings that weren't. And people could tell the difference. So we have brushstrokes going away. We have colors changing. We have perspective being looked at a totally different way. What about the actual content? In the old, the subject matter was clear. Those myths, those gods, religion, the portrait of the rich guy. There was no question in the eyes of the contemporary viewer what it was they were looking at. In the new, you have surrealism, surrealism, the creation of a new alternate reality. This is a quote. My painting is visible images which conceal nothing. They evoke mystery. And indeed, when one sees one of my pictures, one asks oneself the simple question, what does that mean? It does not mean anything, because mystery means nothing either. It is unknowable. René Magritte. In the old, painting was about the subject matter, or about beauty, or both. A painting incorporated paint, incorporated brushstrokes and composition and perspective. Now, instead of a painting being a picture of gods or the neighbors or even the effects of light, which was what the Impressionists were talking about and trying to show, a painting is about painting, or about paint, or about brushstrokes, or about composition, or about perspective. We have obviously invented abstract art, where the painting is about the painting. Let's look at music. There are comparable experiments, developments in the other arts, noticeably music, which becomes atonal, which is analogous to painting becoming abstract. Just as to the thinking visual artist, new techniques were needed to replace the old, to the thinking composers, new scales were needed to replace the old ones. The simple, elegant math of steps and half steps, which is the scale that we know, is invaded by science. And we get 12-tone scales, for instance. All the tools of the musicians are open now to discussion and replacement, as were all the tools of the painter. One thing we didn't comment on with abstract art was whether or not it was aesthetically pleasing, that is, pretty. Nor will we comment on whether atonal music is, well, listenable. We are not here to criticize, but to assume that music is what musicians make. Art is. Art is what artists make, as Duchamp so famously said. And by the way, if you're looking at definitions, abstract, just according to the books, essentially means it's not a realistic representation of something anymore. And obviously, I'm using it in a broader sense. So let's not call what I'm talking about abstract. We'll call it modern. And modern, of course, is what we're really trying to focus on as we move toward the postmodern. Okay, let's look at good old architecture. Architecture remains fascinating in the modern age. Buildings become as modernists as abstract paintings or atonal music have, and because the size of buildings makes them impossible to disregard, their meaning turns modernism into public statements, and will in the postmodern be one of the great emblematic art forms. In other words, you know, if you're not a big fan of painting, well, no matter what goes on in the art studios and the galleries, you can pretty much ignore it. And if you're not a big fan of music, whatever is going on in the concert halls, no matter how atonal it is, no matter how new and different, you can ignore it. But if you're walking down the street and a building is 100 stories high, you can't ignore it. Architecture has always been about the point or purpose of a building and the use of materials, a structural marriage of form and function. Now, in the past, we had the problem of holding up heavy masonry ceilings and walls. With the arrival of the Industrial Revolution, we get the next great phase of architecture, incorporating the use of cast iron and steel. Higher, broader, and lighter buildings become possible. It's simply no longer as difficult to hold up the structure. Steel can hold up virtually anything because it's so strong. And we've had a progression of what buildings were for. The classic buildings we've talked about have primarily been buildings for religion. I mean, I've concentrated on buildings for religion. We sort of put castles aside, but a whole other group of very, very important buildings were castles, the so-called government buildings of their day. Of course, it was simply where the king lives, which of course transmogrified into the buildings of parliaments and the buildings of Congress and the White House and all this sort of thing. So religions and government were the big building builders, the buildings that we would think of as architecture, until we get to the modern age, early modern age, the Industrial Revolution at least, where buildings now also become about business. That's the new group that has the money to build big, our businesses. So anyhow, getting back to materials, that steel girder presents an interesting problem to the architect. What do you do after 2,000 years, 2,000 years of domes and columns and flying buttresses, and all the meaning that those domes and columns and flying buttresses send out to the person looking at or inside a building. In those 2,000 years, there's been an encrustation of tradition where big civic buildings incorporate, of necessity, classical forms and designs, and as a result, the civic idea is inextricably related in the mind to that classicism. A cathedral of the 15th century looks like it does for both narrative and structural purposes. But what should a cathedral look like in the 20th century? When even if the narrative purpose of expressing the infinite and the spiritual remains the same, we don't have the same problem of holding up walls. There are a number of answers to these and similar questions, and I could go on at great length about architecture. And I probably will in some other lecture, but let's stick to the point here. I'll try to keep myself pinned to this sticking point. Okay, there's a number of answers to this and similar questions, and the first big answer is the creation of the skyscraper, which can be seen as the apotheosis of the modern age. Now, there's plenty of modern architecture and modernist architecture that is not tall. By modernist, of course, I'm really talking about the idea of something that looks deliberately futuristic. Okay. But if this is a time of migration to the cities, the idea of buildings reaching into the sky is emblematic of the grasp of the city itself. New York engages itself in a continuing race to construct the tallest possible building, starting with the Woolworth Building and continuing up through the World Trade Center. If reaching for the sky is emblematic of a city's grasp, being the tallest building is a statement of a city's grasp on a global level. Now, the first Manhattan skyscrapers are, to our eyes, simply taller buildings. And the first wave culminates in the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building, both of which were completed in the early 30s, pretty much within, you know, very short period of each other. Both were constructed during that depression in virtually adjoining neighborhoods. I mean, you could see one as you're building the other one. And they waged a literal race to see which one would be the taller. In the end, the Empire State took the prize, which was why the original King Kong and the remake King Kong, or the second remake King Kong, had to climb it. Why would the world's biggest monster climb, say, the fifth highest building? Or even the second highest building, Chrysler, was not in the running. The designs of these early buildings are comparable. They are modernist in the Art Deco sense, full of streamlining to make them look literally modern and futuristic. Curiously, of course, streamlining is a concept of movement. You streamline an object, like a car or an aeroplane, to reduce its resistance to motion through a stream of air. Since skyscrapers do not go anywhere, their streamlining is a statement of concept rather than a structural necessity. The 20s and 30s saw a lot of unnecessary streamlining. Chairs, teapots, cocktail shakers. You don't need a streamlined cocktail shaker. The classic martini glass, however, may be the most modernist, futuristic modernist, piece of glassware ever invented. It is the glass box style that apotheosizes modernism in architecture. This style of building follows the elegant Art Deco structures of the 30s. After the Depression and World War II, the Seagram Building, the UN Building, and finally the World Trade Center marked the simplest form imaginable for their function. Glass boxes as tall as you want them, as long as you leave room for elevators. The World Trade Center makes the clearest, simplest statement possible. Here is the tallest building in the world, and until the Sears Tower replaced it, a monument to international capitalism in a stripped-down, elegant, modern style devoid of meaning-filled contextual decoration. That's why they wanted to knock it down. As we'll eventually see, it is often hard to differentiate between the modern and the postmodern in architecture. But it is not hard to understand what architects are trying to do. Take, for instance, the Guggenheim Museum in New York City. The question is, What is the best way to look at an art exhibit? Presumably, an art exhibit has a beginning, a middle, and an end, a narrative imposed by the exhibit's curator. Our innate narrative sense brings the curator to set an exhibit up as a narrative, and the visitor to observe it as a narrative. You want to make order out of it, so that the visitors will understand the content of the exhibit. This only makes sense. I mean, obviously, if you want to show somebody something, you want them to be able to understand it. So you try to present it in such a way as it'll be understandable. Now, with an art exhibit, you could just post a lot of arrows in a building, originating with a start here and culminating in a this way to the egress next to the gift shop kind of thing, but that's the old way. Or you could design your building with a beginning, a middle, and an end. A building designed with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Now, you could just take a very long, skinny building and do that. But what Frank Lloyd Wright did with the Guggenheim Museum is he created a spiral so that it does indeed have a beginning at the bottom and a middle as you work your way up and an end when you get to the top. Modern construction techniques allow it to be an inverted cone. The thing is upside down. And it's an absolutely perfect place to mount and visit an art exhibit. Or, well, maybe some people might not say it's perfect. It does have some flaws. But I assure you, many is the exhibit I've seen there, and you simply start at the bottom and work your way up, and it's a nice way for displaying a lot of things. It is, perhaps, a perfect meeting of form and function. And a building no longer needs to be a box. It can be an inverted cone. Thanks to modern techniques, it won't fall down. And it is removed completely from all the pre-modern baggage of classical design and decoration. There are no columns. There are no flying buttresses. I'm pretty sure there's no dome. So we don't look at it and get all those feelings we get from domes and columns. We do get a pretty good feeling of space, though, because if you stand at the bottom, you look up, and there's an awful lot of air between you and the ceiling. All new ways of dealing with space. This is the modern age. Let's turn to literature. If we're going to talk about narrative versus narration, books have to be the easiest way to do it, which is why we've saved them for the last. A novel is, by definition, a narrative. So the idea of a non-narrative novel, of a non-narrative narrative, is an oxymoron, a classic. A book is made up of a variety of elements, just as a painting is made up of a variety of elements. Plot, characterization, use of language, Aristotelian dramatic thrust, all these are necessary to make a narrative work. The modernist looks at these elements and redefines them, or eliminates them, or turns them on their head, just as did the abstract painter. We'll look at a few key examples. James Joyce is a good start. He didn't write much, but he was about as avant-garde as they get. In the beginning of his career, he wrote the short stories of the Dubliners, featuring those famous, at least famous to high school English students, epiphanies, where the characters become themselves in their internal moment of realization. Have you ever noticed that nothing much seems to happen in the Dubliners? Now, if you're not paying attention or you don't know what to look for, how do you know the story is over? Well, you turn the page and there's a new story. Compare this to a O. Henry story, where there's a clear action and obvious movement of a resolution. There's a big difference. In all the arts, there's a big difference between the modernist and the non-modernist, the practitioner and the visionary, this school and that school. And don't get the idea from anything I'm saying that everybody was doing the same thing at the same time. Far from it. While Picasso was painting people with eyes on the same side of their head, Norman Rockwell was painting heartwarming, realistic pictures of children playing hooky. Both had probably the same amount of fame and recognition and money in the bank. It's a big world out there. Getting back to Joyce, he worked through a steady line of abstraction over the years, sort of progressing as he went along. He toys with stream of consciousness in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. He just toys with it and presents it full-blown in his next book, Ulysses. That latter book is a fascinating experiment. It's a novel that takes place entirely in one day, based on the structure of Homer's Odyssey, filled with the stream of consciousness language of the modernists. Now, by the time Joyce got to Finnegan's Wake, which is the literary representation of a dream, he'd given up on every piece of what we would consider normal narration. The book has no dramatic arc. It's written in a circle connecting the first and last pages. Joyce invented his own new elusive language. There's no story, no characterization. I have never met anyone who claims to have read this book in its entirety. And it's not just because of the dream structure. Compare Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. It too is a dream, but in a classical novelistic structure. Finnegan is the way it is because that's the way Joyce wrote it. A book you really can't read. Like that atonal music you really can't listen to. William Burroughs clipped together disparate pieces of text. This is reminiscent of the surrealist game The Exquisite Corpse, where multiple writers wrote phrases at random to form a story. Then again, the poet E.E. Cummings stripped out all the capital letters from his poetry and used his own odd method of punctuation. The end result of this sort of experimentation is a narration without meaningful narrative, and often unreadable texts. All of this is bunched into the concept of avant-garde, and these writers, as well as the abstract painters and atonal composers, very much identified themselves as avant-gardists. Now, my reading recommendation is a book called The Avant-Garde Finds Andy Hardy by Robert B. Ray. It's a book of film criticism that discusses some of the main threads of modernist and postmodernist critique, and it's a very good introduction to this area overall. So, is there a cause and effect in all of this? Well, artists are creative thinkers in whatever world, time, place they exist. Their work, at least traditionally, is meant to last, so their work gives us an idea of those worlds and times and places. What the modernists are telling to us from where they are is that they are somehow detached from the reality of their world enough to be able to comment on it, and that they are incorporating the new ideas of this world into their work to make that commentary. Henry Miller said that the true artist must understand science. The artists we're talking about, whatever the art form, incorporate the science of their times into their work, consciously or subconsciously. Eventually, today perhaps, the two are occasionally indistinguishable. As you can see, there is certainly no straight line here. There are all sorts of things happening in many of them, and the theories explaining them are contradictory. And as you move from the modern into the postmodern, it gets even worse. There is a clear delineation between Gothic and Romanesque styles of architecture, but if you look up modernist and postmodernist architecture, for instance, they will both claim certain buildings, the exact same building. Oh, this is modernist. No, it's postmodernist. So have no fear in venturing into these modernist, postmodernist areas. If you're studying a particular person, that's fine. Find out what that person is saying. But overviews, including this one, are awfully reflective of some one person's subjective analysis as compared to some objective truth. Let me tell you what happened. I will connect the random dots of my perceived reality. But sometimes it's better if you connect the dots yourself. One last note. Don't take any of this as being a total picture. Plenty of artists, good artists, were not modernists. Plenty of good artists disregarded modernism as and abstraction, or responded to it differently. No value judgment is implied that an artist who was not a modernist was not a thinking artist. The existence of the modern forces any artist to decide what to do about the modern in his or her own work. Acceptance or rejection of the modern is a personal choice, and for us to claim that one is better than the other is to believe that our ideas on something as ephemeral as what is good art are somehow correct. We will never make that hubristic error of judgment. So to summarize the modern, it is narrative taken to its extremes in an examination of narration. Underlying all of it is still, in most cases, the individual voice of the artist. The work is individual expression, and deliberately so. But it is indeed at the extreme, and that extreme suggests limits. After you've been at the extreme edge, you either retreat or go beyond the edge. You go to postmodernism.